The sound of hoofbeats came from outside. Lizzie thought of Jay. Could he have caught up with them so soon? The sound made Mac uneasy, too, and he said, "If we want to make Staunton by nightfall..." "We don't have time to linger," Lizzie finished. She emptied her tankard.
"You've hardly wet your throats," Baz said. "Drink another cup."
"No," Lizzie said decisively. She took out her pocketbook. "Let me pay you."
Two men walked in, blinking in the dim light. They appeared to be local people. Both were dressed in buckskin trousers and homemade boots. Out of the corner of her eye, Lizzie saw Peg give a start, then turn her back on the newcomers, as if she did not want them to see her face. One of them spoke cheerily.
"Hello, strangers!"
He was an ugly man with a broken nose and one closed eye.
"I'm Chris Dobbs, known as Deadeye Double. A pleasure to meet you. What news from the East? Them burgesses still spending our taxes on new palaces and fancy dinners? Let me buy you a drink. Rum all round, please, Baz."
"We're leaving," Lizzie said. "Thanks all the same."
Dobbo looked more closely at her and said,
"A woman in buckskin pants."
She ignored him and said,
"Goodbye, Baz, and thanks for the information."
Mac went out, and Lizzie and Peg moved to the door. Dobbs looked at Peg and registered surprise.
"I know you," he said. "I've seen you with Burgo Mahler, God rest his soul."
"Never heard of him," Peg said boldly and walked past.
In the next second, the man drew the logical conclusion.
"Jesus Christ, you must be the little bitch that killed him."
"Wait a minute," Lizzie said. She wished Mac had not gone out so quickly. "I don't know what crazy idea you've got into your head, Mr. Dobbs, but Jenny has been a maid in my family since she was 10 years old, and she has never met anyone called Burgo Mahler, let alone killed him."
He was not to be put off so easily.
"Her name isn't Jenny, though it's something like that. Betty, or Millie, or Peggy. That's it. She's Peggy Knapp."
Lizzie felt sick with fear. Dobbs turned to his companion for support.
"Ain't it her now?"
The other man shrugged.
"I never saw Burgo's convict more than a time or two, and one little girl looks much the same as another," he said dubiously.
Baz said,
"She fits the description in the Virginia Gazette, though."
He reached under the counter and came up with a musket. Lizzie's fear went away, and she felt angry.
"I hope you aren't thinking of threatening me, Barney Tobold," she said, and her voice surprised her by its strength.
He replied, "Maybe you should all stay around while we get a message to the sheriff in Staunton. He feels bad about not catching Burgo's murderer. I know he'll want to check your story."
"I'm not going to wait around while you find out you're mistaken."
He leveled the gun at her.
"I think you're going to have to."
"Let me explain something to you. I'm walking out of here with this child, and there's only one thing that you need to know. If you shoot the wife of a wealthy Virginian gentleman, no excuse on earth is going to keep you from the gallows."
She put her hands on Peg's shoulders, stepped between her and the gun, and pushed her forward. Baz cocked the flintlock with a deafening click. Peg twitched under Lizzie's hands, and Lizzie tightened her grip, sensing the girl wanted to break into a run. It was 3 yards to the door, but they seemed to take an hour to get there. No shot rang out. Lizzie felt sunshine on her face. She could contain herself no longer. Shoving Peg forward, she began to run. Mac was already in the saddle. Peg jumped up on the seat of the wagon and Lizzie followed.
"What happened?" Mac said. "You look as if you've seen a ghost."
"Let's get out of here," Lizzie said, snapping the reins. "That one-eyed fellow recognized Peg." She turned the wagon to the east. If they headed for Staunton, they would first have to ford the river, which would take too long, and then they would be riding into the sheriff's arms. They had to go back the way they had come. Looking over her shoulder, she saw the three men in the tavern doorway, Baz still holding the musket. She whipped the horses into a trot. Baz did not shoot. A few seconds later, they were out of range.
"By God," Lizzie said gratefully, "that was a nasty moment."
The road turned a corner into the woods, and they passed out of sight of the tavern. After a while, Lizzie slowed the horses to a walk. Mac brought his horse alongside.
"We forgot to buy oats," he said.
Mac was relieved to escape, but he regretted Lizzie's decision to turn back. They should have forded the river and gone on. Staunton was obviously where Burgo Mahler's farm was, but they could have found a side trail around the town or slipped through at night.
However, he did not criticize her, for she had been forced to make an instant decision. They stopped where they had made camp the night before, at the place where Three-Notch Trail was crossed by a side trail. They drove the wagon off the main road and concealed it in the woods. They were now fugitives from justice. Mac looked at his map and decided they would have to go back to Charlottesville and take the Seminole Trail south. They could turn west again after a day or two without coming within 50 miles of Staunton. However, in the morning it occurred to Mac that Dobbs might be heading for Charlottesville. He could have passed by their hidden campsite after dark and reached the town ahead of them. He told Lizzie of his worry and proposed riding into Charlottesville alone to check that the coast was clear. She agreed. He rode hard and reached the town before sunrise. He slowed his horse to a walk as he approached the first house. The place was quiet. Nothing was moving but an old dog scratching itself in the middle of the road. The door of the Swan Tavern was open, and smoke came from its chimney. Mac dismounted and tied his horse to a bush, then cautiously approached the tavern. There was no one in the bar. Perhaps Dobbs and his sidekick had been heading the other way, towards Staunton. A mouth-watering smell was coming from somewhere. He went around to the back and saw a middle-aged woman frying bacon. "I need to buy oats," he said. Without looking up from her work, she said, "There's a store opposite the courthouse." "Thanks. Have you seen Deadeye Dobble?" "Who the hell is he?" "Never mind. Would you like some breakfast before you go?" "No, thanks. I wish I had time." Leaving his horse, he went up the hill to the wooden courthouse. Across the square was a smaller building with a roughly painted sign saying Seed Merchant. It was locked up, but in an outhouse at the back he found a half-dressed man shaving. "I need to buy oats," he said again, "and I need a shave. I'm not going to wait. Sell me 2 sacks of oats now, or I'll get them at the South River Ford." Grumbling, the man wiped his face and led Mac into the store. "Any strangers in town?" Mac asked him. "You?" he replied. It seemed Dobbs had not come here last night. Mac paid with Lizzie's money and took the 2 big sacks on his back. When he went outside, he heard hooves and looked up to see 3 horsemen riding in from the east, going fast. His heart skipped a beat. "Friends of yours?" said the seed merchant. "No." He hurried down the hill. The riders pulled up at the Swan. Mac slowed his pace as he approached and tipped his hat down over his eyes. As they dismounted, he studied their faces. One of them was Jay Jamison. Mac cursed under his breath. Jay had almost caught up, thanks to yesterday's trouble at South River. Luckily, Mac had been cautious, and as a result he was forewarned. Now he had to reach his horse and get away without being seen. Suddenly he realized that his horse had been stolen from Jay, and it was roped to a bush not 3 yards away from where Jay now stood. Jay loved his horses. If he gave this one a glance, he would recognize it as his own, and he would know in a flash that the runaways were not far away. Mac stepped over a broken fence into an overgrown lot and watched through a screen of bushes. Lennox was with Jay, and there was another man he did not recognize. Lennox tied up his mount next to Mac's, partly masking the stolen horse from Jay's view. Lennox had no love of horses and would not recognize the beast. Jay tied up next to Lennox. "Go inside, go inside," Mac shouted in his head. But Jay turned and said something to Lennox. Lennox replied, and the other man laughed coarsely. A drop of sweat rolled down Mac's forehead and into his eye, and he blinked it away. When his vision cleared, the 3 were walking into the Swan. He breathed a sigh of relief, but it was not over yet. He came out of the bushes, still bent under the weight of 2 sacks of oats, and walked quickly across the road to the tavern. He transferred the sacks to the horse. He heard someone behind him. He did not dare to look around. He put 1 foot in the stirrup, then a voice said, "Hey, you!" Slowly Mac turned. The speaker was the stranger. He took a deep breath and said, "What?" "We want breakfast." "See the woman out back?" Mac mounted his horse. "Hey, what now?" "Has a 4-horse wagon passed through here with a woman, a girl, and a man?" Mac pretended to think. "Not lately," he said. He kicked his horse and rode off. He did not dare to look back. A minute later, he had left the town behind. He was anxious to get back to Lizzie and Peg, but he was forced to go more slowly because of the weight of the oats, and the sun was warm by the time he reached the crossing. He turned off the road and down the side trail to the hidden campsite.
"Jay is in Charlottesville," he said as soon as he saw Lizzie.
She paled.
"So close. He'll probably follow Three Notch Trail across the mountains later today. But as soon as he reaches the South River Ford, he'll find out that we turn back. That will put him only a day and a half behind us. We'll have to abandon the wagon. And all our supplies. Most of them. We have 3 spare horses. We can take whatever they will carry."
Mac looked along the narrow trail leading south from the camp.
"Instead of going back to Charlottesville, we could try taking this track south. It probably cuts a corner and meets up with the Seminole Trail a few miles out of town. And it looks passable for horses."
Lizzie was not the type to whine. Her mouth set in a determined line.
"All right," she said grimly. "Let's start unloading."
They had to abandon the plowshare, Lizzie's trunk full of warm underwear, and some of the cornmeal. But they managed to keep the guns, the tools, and the seed. They roped the pack horses together, then mounted up. By mid-morning, they were on their way. Chapter 38. For 3 days they followed the primeval Seminole Trail southwest through a majestic series of valleys and passes that wound between lush, forested mountains. They passed isolated farms, but they saw few people and no towns. They rode 3 abreast, the pack horses following in a line. Mac became saddle sore, but despite that he felt exhilarated. The mountains were magnificent, the sun was shining, and he was a free man. On the morning of the 4th day, they breasted a rise and saw, in the valley below, a wide brown river with a series of midstream islands. On the far bank was a cluster of wooden buildings. A broad, flat-bottomed ferry boat was tied up at a jetty. Mac reined in.
"My guess is that this is the James River, and that settlement is a place called Lynch's Ferry."
Lizzie guessed what he was thinking.
"You want to turn west again?"
He nodded.
"We've seen almost nobody for 3 days. Jay will have trouble picking up our scent. But if we cross that ferry, we'll meet the ferryman, and it might be hard to avoid the tavern keeper, the storekeeper, and all the local busybodies."
"Good thinking," Lizzie said. "If we get off the road here, he won't be able to figure out which way we've gone." Mac looked at his map.
"The valley climbs to the northwest and leads to a pass. Beyond the pass, we should be able to join the trail that runs southwest from Staunton."
"Good." Mac smiled at Peg, who was silent and indifferent.
"Are you in agreement?" he said,
trying to bring her into the decision.
"Whatever you want," she said.
She seemed unhappy, and Mac assumed it was because she was frightened of being caught. She must be tired, too. Sometimes he forgot that she was so small.
"Cheer up," he said. "We're escaping."
She looked away. He exchanged glances with Lizzie, who made a helpless gesture. They turned off the trail at an angle and went down through sloping woodland to reach the river 1/2 mile or so upstream from the settlement. Mac thought they probably had not been observed. A flat track ran west along the bank for several miles. Then it turned away from the river, skirting a range of hills. The going was hard, and they frequently had to dismount and lead the horses up stony rises. But Mac never lost the intoxicating feeling of freedom. They ended the day beside a fast-running mountain stream. Lizzie shot a small deer that came to drink from a rocky pool. Mac butchered it and made a spit to roast a haunch. Leaving Peg to watch the fire, he went to wash his blood-stained hands. He made his way downstream to where a small waterfall dropped into a deep pool. He knelt on a ledge and washed his hands in the falling water. Then he decided to bathe and took off all his clothes. He stepped out of his breeches and looked up to see Lizzie.
"Every time I take off my clothes and jump in a river, you find me watching."
They both laughed.
"Come and bathe with me," he said.
His heart beat faster as she stripped. He gazed lovingly at her body. She stood naked in front of him with a what-the-hell expression on her face. They embraced and kissed. When they paused for breath, he was struck by a foolish notion. He looked down at the deep pool 10 feet below and said,
"Let's jump."
"No," she said. Then she said,
"All right."
They held hands, stood at the edge of the shelf and jumped, laughing helplessly. They hit the water, holding hands. Mac went under and let go of Lizzie. When he surfaced, he saw her a few feet away, snorting and blowing and laughing at the same time. Together they swam towards the bank until they felt the river bed below their feet. Then they stopped to rest. End of side 18. Side 19. Mac drew her to him. With the thrill of excitement, he felt her bare thighs against his. He did not want to kiss her now. He wanted to look at her face. He stroked her hips. Her hand closed around his stiff penis, and she looked into his eyes and smiled happily. He felt as if he would explode. She put her arms around his neck and lifted her legs so that her thighs squeezed his waist. He settled his feet firmly on the river bed and took her weight. He lifted her a fraction. She wriggled a little and settled on him. He slid inside her as easily as if they had been practicing for years. After the cold water, her flesh was like hot oil on his skin. Suddenly he felt as if he were in a dream. He was making love to Lady Hallam's daughter in a waterfall in Virginia. How could it be real? She put her tongue in his mouth, and he sucked it. She giggled. Then her face became serious again, and a look of concentration came over her. She pulled on his neck, lifting herself, then let her body sink down again, repeatedly. She groaned deep in her throat and half closed her eyes. He watched her face, mesmerized. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw something move on the bank. He turned his head and glimpsed a flash of color, then it was gone. Someone had been watching. Had Peg stumbled on them accidentally? Or was it a stranger? He knew he should worry, but Lizzie moaned louder, and the thought left his mind. She began to cry out. Her thighs squeezed him in a rhythm that went faster and faster. Then she crushed her body to his and screamed, and he held her tight and shook with passion until he was drained. When they returned to the campsite, Peg was gone. Mac had a bad feeling. I thought I saw someone down by the pool when we were making love. It was just a glimpse, and I couldn't even tell whether it was man, woman, or child. I'm sure it was Peg, Lizzie said. I think she's run off. Mac narrowed his eyes. What makes you so sure? She's jealous of me because you love me. What? She loves you, Mac. She told me she was going to marry you. Of course it's just a girlish fantasy, but she doesn't know that. She's been miserable for days, and I think she saw us making love and ran away. Mac had a dreadful feeling that this was true. He imagined how Peg felt, and the thought was agonizing. Now that poor child was wandering alone in the mountains at night. Oh, God, what are we going to do? He said. Look for her. Aye, Mac shook himself. At least she hasn't taken a horse. She can't have gone far. We'll search together. Let's make torches. She's probably gone back the way we came. We'll find her asleep under a bush, I'll bet. They searched all night. They backtracked for hours, shining their lights into the woods on either side of the winding trail. Then they returned to their camp, made new torches, and followed the stream up the mountainside, scrambling over rocks. There was no sign of her. At dawn, they ate some of the venison haunch, loaded their supplies on the horses, and went on. It was possible she had gone west, and Mac hoped they would stumble on her on the track. But all that morning they walked without finding her. At midday they came upon another trail. It was just a dirt road, but it was wider than a wagon, and there were hoof marks in the mud. It ran from northeast to southwest, and in the distance beyond it they could see a range of majestic mountains rising into the blue sky. This was the road they had been searching for, the way to the Cumberland Gap. With heavy hearts they turned southwest and rode on. Chapter 39. On the morning of the next day, Jay Jamison walked his horse down the hill to the James River and looked across the water to the settlement called Lynch's Ferry. Jay was exhausted, aching, and dispirited. He intensely disliked Binns, the ruffian Lennox had hired in Williamsburg. He was weary of bad food, filthy clothes, long days in the saddle, and short nights on the hard ground. In the last few days, his hopes had gone up and down like the endless hill tracks he was travelling on. He had been tremendously excited when he reached the South River ford and learned that Lizzie and her partners in crime had been forced to turn back. However, he was puzzled about how they had passed him on the road. "They turned off the trail somewhere," Deadeye Dobbo had said confidently as they sat in the tavern beside the river. Dobbs had seen the three fugitives the previous day and had recognized Peg Knapp as the missing convict who had killed Burgo Marler. Jay supposed he must be right, but did they go north or south? He said worriedly.
If you're running from the law, south is the direction you need, away from sheriffs and courthouses and magistrates.
Jay was not so certain. There might be lots of places in the 13 colonies where an apparently respectable family group, husband, wife, and maidservant, could quietly settle down and effectively disappear. But Dobbs's guess seemed more likely. He told Dobbs, as he told everyone, that he would pay a reward of 50 English pounds to anyone who arrested the fugitives. The money, enough to buy a small farm out here, had come from his mother. When they parted, Dobbs crossed the ford and went west towards Staunton. Jay hoped he would spread the word about the reward. If the fugitives managed somehow to give Jay the slip, they might yet be caught by others. Jay returned to Charlottesville, expecting to find that Lizzie had passed through Charlottesville and turned south. However, the wagon had not been seen again. Jay could only guess they had somehow bypassed Charlottesville and found another route to the southbound Seminole Trail. Gambling on that assumption, he had led his gang along the trail. But the countryside was becoming lonelier, and they met no one who recalled seeing a man, a woman, and a young girl on the road. However, he had high hopes of getting some information here at Lynch's Ferry. They reached the bank and shouted across the fast-moving river. A figure emerged from a building and got into a boat. A rope was stretched from one bank to the other, and the ferry was attached to the rope in an ingenious way so that the pressure of the river's flow drove the boat across the river. When it reached the near bank, Jay and his companions led their horses aboard. The ferryman adjusted the ropes, and the boat began to move back across. The man had the dark clothes and sober manner of a Quaker. Jay paid him and began to question him as they crossed the river. "We're looking for a group of three people, a young woman, a Scotsman of about the same age, and a young girl of 14. Have they been through here?" The man shook his head. Jay's heart sank. He wondered if he was on the wrong track entirely. "Could someone have passed through here without you seeing them?" The man took his time replying. Eventually he said, "He'd have to be a heck of a good swimmer."
"Suppose they crossed the river somewhere else?"
There was another pause, and he said, "Then they didn't pass through here." Bin snickered, and Lennox silenced him with a malevolent glare. Jay looked out over the river and cursed under his breath. She had not been seen for 6 days. She had slipped away from him somehow. She could be anywhere. She could be in Pennsylvania. She could have returned to the east and be on a ship heading for London. He had lost her. She had outwitted him and cheated him of his inheritance. "If ever I see her again, by God, I'll shoot her in the head," he thought. In fact, he did not know what he would do if he caught her. He worried at the question constantly as he rode the uneven trails. He knew she would not willingly come back to him. He would have to bring her home, bound hand and foot. She might not yield to him even after that. He would probably have to rape her. The thought excited him strangely. On the trail he was disturbed by lascivious memories, the two of them caressing in the attic of the empty Chapel Street house with their mothers outside. Lizzie bouncing on their bed, naked and shameless, making love with Lizzie on top, squirming and moaning. But when she was pregnant, how would he make her stay? Could he lock her away until she gave birth? Everything would be much simpler if she died. It was not unlikely. She and McCash would surely put up a fight. Jay did not think he could murder his wife in cold blood, but he could hope she might get killed in a fight. Then he could marry a healthy barmaid, make her pregnant, and take ship for London to claim his inheritance. But that was a happy dream. The reality was that when he finally confronted her, he would have to make a decision. Either he took her home alive, giving her ample opportunity to frustrate his plans, or he had to kill her. How would he dispatch her? He had never killed anyone, and had only once used his sword to injure people, at the Coal Yard riot when he had captured McCash. Even when he hated Lizzie most, he could not imagine plunging a sword into the body he had made love to. He had once trained his rifle on his brother and pulled the trigger. If he had to kill Lizzie, it might be best to shoot her from a distance, like a deer. But he was not sure he could manage even that. The ferry reached the other side. Alongside the landing was a substantial wood-frame building with 2 stories and an attic. Several more well-built houses were neatly ranged on the slope that rose steeply from the river. The place seemed a prosperous small trading community. As they disembarked, the ferryman said casually, "There's somebody waiting for you all in the tavern."
"Waiting for us?" said Jay in astonishment. "How did anyone know we were coming?"
The ferryman answered a different question. Mean-looking fellow with one closed eye.
Dobbs, how did he get here ahead of us?
Lennox added, and why?
Ask him, said the ferryman.
The news had lifted Jez's spirits, and he was eager to solve the riddle. You men deal with the horses, he ordered. I'll go and see Dobbs. The tavern was the two-story building alongside the ferry dock. He stepped inside and saw Dobbs sitting at a table, eating stew from a bowl.
Dobbs, what the devil are you doing here?
Dobbs raised his good eye and spoke with his mouth full.
Ah, come to claim that reward, Captain Jamieson.
What are you talking about?
Look over there.
He nodded towards the corner. There, tied to a chair, was Peg Knapp. Jay stared at her.
This was a piece of luck. Where the hell did she come from?
I found her on the road south of Staunton.
Jay frowned. Which way was she heading?
North, towards the town. I was coming out of town, going to Miller's Mill.
I wonder how she got there.
I've asked her, but she won't talk.
Jay looked again at the girl and saw bruises on her face. Dobbs had not been gentle with her.
I'll tell you what I think, Dobbs said. They came almost this far, but they never crossed the river. Instead, they turned west. They must have abandoned their wagon somewhere. They went on horseback up the river valley to the Staunton Road.
But you found Peg on her own?
Yes.
So you picked her up?
It wasn't that easy, Dobbs protested. She ran like the wind, and every time I grabbed her, she slipped through my fingers. But I was on a horse, and she wasn't, and in the end she tired.
A Quaker woman appeared and asked Jay if he wanted something to eat. He waved her away impatiently. He was too eager to question Dobbs.
But how did you get here ahead of us?
He grinned.
I came down the river on a raft.
There must have been a quarrel, Jay said excitedly. This murdering little bitch left the others and turned north, so the others must have gone south.
He frowned.
Where do they imagine they're going?
The road leads to Fort Chiswell. Beyond that, there's not much in the way of settled land. Further south is a place called Wolf Hills, and after that, it's Cherokee country. They aren't going to become Cherokee, so I'd guess they'll turn west at Wolf Hills and head up into the hills. Hunters talk about a pass called Cumberland Gap that leads across the mountains, but I've never been there.
What's on the other side?
Wilderness, they say. Good hunting. Kind of a no-man's land between the Cherokee and the Sioux. They call it the Bluegrass Country.
Jay saw it now. Lizzie was planning to start a new life in undiscovered country. But she would fail, he thought excitedly. He would catch her and bring her back, dead or alive.
The child is not worth much on her own, he said to Dobbs. You have to help us catch the other two if you want your 50 pounds.
You want me to be your guide?
Yes.
They're a couple of days ahead of you now, and they can travel fast without the wagon. It's going to take you a week or more to catch up.
You get the whole 50 pounds if we succeed.
I hope we can make up the time before they leave the trail and go off into the wilderness.
Amen to that, said Jay. Chapter 40 10 days after Peg ran off, Mac and Lizzie rode across a wide, flat plain and reached the mighty Holston River. Mac was elated. They had crossed numerous streams and creeks, but there was no doubt in his mind that this was the one they were looking for. It was much wider than the others, with a long midstream island.
This is it, he said to Lizzie. This is the edge of civilization.
For several days they had felt almost alone in the world. Yesterday they had seen one white man, a trapper, and three Indians on a distant hill. Today, no white men and several groups of Indians. The Indians were neither friendly nor hostile. They kept a distance. Mac and Lizzie had not passed a cultivated field for a long time. As the farms became fewer, the game had increased. Bison, deer, rabbits, and millions of edible birds, turkeys, duck, woodcocks, and quail. Lizzie shot more than the two of them could eat. The weather had been kind. Once it had rained, and they had trudged through mud all day and shivered, soaking wet all night. But the next day the sun had dried them out. They were saddle-sore and bone-tired, but the horses were holding up, fortified by the lush grass that was everywhere and the oats Mac had bought in Charlottesville. They had seen no sign of Jay, but that did not mean much. Mac had to assume he was still following them. They watered the horses in the Holston and sat down to rest on the rocky shore. The trail had petered out as they crossed the plain, and beyond the river there was not the faintest sign of a track.
To the north, the ground rose steadily, and in the far distance, perhaps 10 miles away, a high ridge rose forbiddingly into the sky. That was where they were headed. Mac said, "There must be a pass."
"I don't see it," said Lizzie.
"Nor do I.
If it isn't there, we'll look for another one," he said resolutely.
He spoke confidently, but at heart he was fearful. They were going into unmapped country. They might be attacked by mountain lions or wild bears. The Indians could turn hostile. At present there was plenty of food for anyone with a rifle, but what would happen in winter? He took out his map, though it was proving increasingly inaccurate.
"I wish we'd met someone who knew the way," Lizzie fretted.
"We've met several," he said, "and each told a different story."
"They all painted the same picture, though," Mac said.
"The river valleys slant from northeast to southwest, just as the map shows, and we have to go northwest at right angles to the rivers across a series of high ridges.
The problem will be to find the passes that cut through the mountain ranges.
We'll just have to zigzag. Whenever we see a pass that could take us north, we go that way. When we come up against a ridge that looks impassable, we turn west and follow the valley, all the time looking out for our next chance to turn north. The passes may not be where this map shows them to be, but they're in there somewhere."
"Well, there's nothing to do now but try," she said.
"If we get into trouble, we'll have to retrace our steps and try a different route, that's all."
She smiled.
"I'd rather do this than pay calls in Berkeley Square."
He grinned back. She was ready for anything. He loved that about her.
"It beats digging for coal, too."
Lizzie's face became solemn again.
"I just wish Peg was here."
Mac felt the same way. They had seen no trace of Peg after she ran off. They had hoped they would catch up with her that first day, but it had not happened. Lizzie had cried all that night. She felt she had lost 2 children, first her baby and then Peg. They had no idea where she might be or whether she was even alive. They had done all they could to look for her, but that thought was small consolation. After all Mac and Peg had been through together, he had lost her in the end. Tears came to his eyes whenever he thought about her. But now he and Lizzie could make love every night under the stars. It was spring and the weather was mild. Soon they would build their house and make love indoors. After that, they had to store up salt meat and smoked fish for the winter. Meanwhile, he would clear a field and plant their seeds. He got to his feet.
"That was a short rest," Lizzie said as she stood up.
"I'll be happier when we're out of sight of this river," Mac said. "Jay might guess our route thus far, but this is where we shake him off."
Reflexively, they both looked back the way they had come. There was no one in sight. But Jay was on that road somewhere, Mac felt sure. Then he realized they were being watched. He had seen a movement out of the corner of his eye, and now he saw it again. Tensing, he slowly turned his head. 2 Indians were standing just a few yards away. This was the northern edge of Cherokee country, and they had been seeing the natives at a distance for 3 days, but none had approached them. These were 2 boys about 17 years old. They had the straight black hair and reddish tan skin characteristic of the original Americans, and wore the deerskin tunic and trousers the new immigrants had copied. The taller of the 2 held out a large fish like a salmon.
"I want a knife," he said.
Mac guessed the 2 of them had been fishing in this river.
"You want to trade?" Mac said.
The boy smiled.
"I want a knife."
Lizzie said,
"We don't need a fish, but we could use a guide. I'll bet he knows where the pass is."
That was a good idea. It would be a tremendous relief to know where they were going.
Mac said eagerly, "Will you guide us?"
The boy smiled, but it was obvious he did not understand. His companion remained silent and still. Mac tried again.
"Will you be our guide?"
He began to look troubled.
"No trade today," he said doubtfully.
Mac sighed in frustration.
He said to Lizzie, "He's an enterprising kid who's learned a few English phrases, but he can't really speak the language."
It would be maddening to get lost here just because they could not communicate with the local people.
Lizzie said, "Let me try."
She went to one of the pack horses, opened a leather satchel, and took out a long-bladed knife. It had been made at the forge on the plantation, and the letter J for Jamison was burned into the wood of the handle. It was crude by comparison with what you could buy in London, but no doubt it was superior to anything the Cherokee could make themselves. She showed it to the boy. He smiled broadly. "I'll buy that," he said, and reached for it. Lizzie withdrew it. The boy offered the fish, and she pushed it away. He looked troubled again. "Look," Lizzie said. She bent over a large stone with a flat surface. Using the point of the knife, she began to scratch a picture. First, she drew a jagged line. She pointed at the distant mountains, then at the line. "This is the ridge," she said. Mac could not tell whether the boy understood or not. Below the ridge, she drew two stick figures, then pointed at herself and Mac. "This is us," she said. "Now, watch carefully." She drew a second ridge, then a deep V-shape joining the two. "This is the pass," she said. Finally, she put a stick figure in the V. "We need to find the pass," she said, and she looked expectantly at the boy. Mac held his breath. "I'll buy that," the boy said, and he offered Lizzie the fish. Mac groaned. "Don't lose hope," Lizzie snapped at him. She addressed the Indian again. "This is the ridge. This is us. Here's the pass. We need to find the pass." Then she pointed at him. "You take us to the pass, and you get the knife." He looked at the mountains, then at the drawing, then at Lizzie. "Pass," he said. Lizzie pointed at the mountains. He drew a V-shape in the air, then pointed through it. "Pass," he said again. "I'll buy that," Lizzie said. The boy grinned broadly and nodded vigorously. Mac said, "Do you think he got the message?" "I don't know." She hesitated, then took her horse's bridle and began to walk on. "Shall we go?" she said to the boy with a gesture of invitation. He started to walk beside her. "Hallelujah," said Mac. The other Indian came too. They struck out along the bank of a stream. The horses settled into the steady gait that had brought them 500 miles in 22 days. Gradually the distant ridge loomed larger, but Mac saw no sign of a pass. The terrain rose remorselessly, but the ground seemed less rough, and the horses went a little faster. Mac realized the boys were following a trail only they could see. Letting the Indians take the lead, they continued to head straight for the ridge. They went all the way to the foot of the mountain and suddenly turned east. Then, to Mac's enormous relief, they saw the pass. "Well done, fish boy," he said joyfully. They forded a river and curved around the mountain to emerge on the far side of the ridge. As the sun went down, they found themselves in a narrow valley with a fast-flowing stream about 25 feet wide, running northeast. Ahead of them was another ridge. "Let's make camp," Mac said. "In the morning we'll go up the valley and look for another pass." Mac felt good. They had followed no obvious route, and the pass had been invisible from the river bank. Jay could not possibly follow them here. He began to believe he had escaped at last. Lizzie gave the taller boy the knife. "Thank you, fish boy," she said. Mac hoped the Indians would stay with them. They could have all the knives they wanted if they would guide Mac and Lizzie through the mountains. But they turned and went back the way they had come, the taller of the two still carrying his fish. A few moments later, they had disappeared into the twilight. Chapter 41. Jay was convinced they would catch Lizzie today. He kept up a fast pace, driving the horses hard. "They can't be far ahead," he kept saying. However, there was still no sign of the fugitives when he reached the Holston River at dusk. He was angry. "We can't go on in the dark," he said as his men watered their horses. "I thought we would have caught them by now." "We're not far behind. Calm down," Lennox said testily. As the group travelled farther from civilization, he became more insolent. Dobbs put in, "But we can't tell which way they went from here. There's no trail across the mountains. Any fool that wants to go has to find his own route." End of side 19. Side 20. They hobbled the horses and tied Peg to a tree while Lennox prepared hominy for supper. It had been 4 days since they saw a tavern, and Jay was sick of eating the mush he fed his slaves, but it was now too dark to shoot game. They were all blistered and exhausted. Bins had dropped out at Fort Chiswell, and now Dobbs was losing heart.
I should give up and go back, he said. It ain't worth £50 to get lost in the mountains and die.
Jay did not want him to go. He was the only one with any local knowledge.
But we haven't caught up with my wife yet, Jay said.
I don't care about your wife.
Give it one more day. Everyone says the way across the mountains is north of here. Let's see if we can find the pass. We may catch her tomorrow.
And we may waste our damn time.
Lennox spooned the lumpy porridge into bowls. Dobbs untied Peg's hands long enough for her to eat, then tied her up again and threw a blanket over her. No one cared much for her well-being, but Dobbs wanted to take her to the Staunton sheriff. He seemed to think he would be admired for capturing her.
Lennox got out a bottle of rum. They wrapped themselves in their blankets and passed the bottle and made desultory conversation. The hours went by and the moon rose. Jay dozed fitfully. At some point he opened his eyes and saw a strange face at the edge of the circle of firelight. He was so scared he could not make a sound. It was a peculiar face, young but alien, and he realized after a few moments that it belonged to an Indian. The face was smiling, but not at Jay. Jay followed the gaze and saw that it was focused on Peg. She was making faces at the Indian, and after a minute Jay figured that she was trying to get him to untie her. Jay lay dead still and watched. There were two Indians, he saw. They were young boys. One of them stepped silently into the circle. He was carrying a big fish. He put it gently down on the ground, then drew a knife and bent over Peg. Lennox was as quick as a snake. Jay hardly saw what happened. There was a blur of movement, and Lennox had the boy in an armlock. The knife fell to the ground. Peg gave a cry of disappointment. The second Indian vanished. Jay stood up. What have we here? Dobbs rubbed his eyes and stared.
Just an Indian boy, trying to rob us. We should hang him as a lesson to the others. Not yet, said Lennox. He may have seen the people we're after.
That thought lifted Jay's hopes. He stood in front of the boy.
Say something, savage.
Lennox twisted the boy's arm harder. He cried out and protested in his own language.
Speak English, Lennox barked. Listen to me, Jay said loudly. Have you seen two people, a man and a woman, on this road?
No trade today, the boy said.
He does speak English, Dobbs said.
I don't think he can tell us anything, though, Jay said dispiritedly.
Oh, yes, he can, Lennox said. Hold him for me, Dobbo.
Dobbs took over, and Lennox picked up the knife the Indian had dropped.
Look at this. It's one of ours. It has the letter J burned into the handle.
Jay looked. It was true. The knife had been made at his plantation.
Why, then he must have met Lizzie,
Lennox said. Exactly.
Jay felt hopeful again. Lennox held the knife in front of the Indian's eyes and said,
Which way did they go, boy?
He struggled, but Dobbs held him tight.
No trade today,
he said in a terrified voice. Lennox took the boy's left hand. He hooked the point of the knife under the nail of the index finger.
Which way? He said, and he pulled out the nail.
The boy and Peg screamed at the same time.
Stop it! Peg yelled. Leave him alone!
Lennox pulled out another fingernail. The boy began to sob.
Which way to the pass? Lennox said.
Pass,
the boy said, and with a bleeding hand he pointed north. Jay gave a sigh of satisfaction.
You can take us there, he said.
Chapter 42 Mac dreamed he was wading across a river to a place called Freedom. The water was cold, the river bottom was uneven, and there was a strong current. He kept striding forward, but the bank never got any closer, and the river became deeper with every stride. All the same, he knew that if he could just keep going, he would eventually get there. But the water got deeper and deeper, and eventually it closed over his head. Gasping for breath, he woke up. He heard one of the horses whinny.
Something's disturbed them, he said.
There was no reply. He turned over and saw that Lizzie was not beside him. Perhaps she had gone to answer a call of nature behind a bush, but he had a bad feeling. He rolled quickly out of his blanket and stood up. The sky was streaked with grey, and he could see the four mares and two stallions, all standing still, as if they had heard other horses in the distance. Someone was coming.
"Lizzie?" he called.
Then Jay stepped from behind a tree with a rifle pointed at Mac's heart. Mac froze. A moment later, Sidney Lennox appeared with a pistol in each hand. Mac stood there helpless. Despair engulfed him like the river in his dream. He had not escaped after all. They had caught him.
But where was Lizzie?
The one-eyed man from South River Ford, Deadeye Dobbo, rode up, also carrying a rifle, with Peg on another horse beside him, her feet tied together under the horse's belly so she could not get off. She did not seem to be injured, but she looked suicidally miserable, and Mac knew she blamed herself for this. Fishboy was walking alongside Dobbs's horse, tied by a long rope to Dobbs's saddle. He must have led them here. His hands were covered with blood. For a moment Mac was mystified. The boy had shown no sign of injury before. Then he realized that he had been tortured. He felt a wave of disgust for Jay and Lennox. Jay was staring at the blankets on the ground. It was obvious that Mac and Lizzie had been sleeping together.
"You filthy pig," he said, his face working with rage. "Where's my wife?"
He reversed his rifle and swung the butt at Mac's head, hitting him a bone-crunching blow to the side of the face. Mac staggered and fell.
"Where is she, you coal-mining animal? Where's my wife?"
Mac tasted blood.
"I don't know." "If you don't know, I might as well have the satisfaction of shooting you through the head."
Mac realized Jay meant it. Sweat broke out all over him. He felt the impulse to beg for his life, but he clamped his teeth together.
Peg screamed, "No, don't shoot, please!"
Jay pointed the rifle at Mac's head. His voice rose to a hysterical pitch.
"This is for all the times you've defied me!" he screamed.
Mac looked into his face and saw murder in his eyes. Lizzie lay belly down on a grassy tuft behind a rock, with her rifle in her hand, waiting. She had picked her spot the night before, after inspecting the river bank and seeing the footprints and droppings of deer. As the light strengthened, she watched, lying dead still, waiting for the animals to come to drink. Her skill with the rifle was going to keep them alive, she reckoned. Mac could build a house and clear fields and sow seed, but it would be at least a year before they could grow enough to last them through a winter. However, there were three big sacks of salt among their supplies. Lizzie had often sat in the kitchen of Hyde Lane House watching Jeanie, the cook, salting hams and haunches of venison in big barrels. She knew how to smoke fish, too. They would need plenty. The way she and Mac were behaving, there would be three to feed before a year passed. She smiled happily. There was a movement in the trees. A moment later, a young deer came out of the woods and stepped daintily to the water's edge. Bending its head, it stuck out its tongue and began to drink. Lizzie cocked the flintlock of her rifle silently. Before she could aim, another deer followed the first, and within a few moments there were 12 or 15 of them. "If all the wilderness is like this," Lizzie thought, "we'll grow fat." She did not want a big deer. The horses were fully loaded and could not carry spare meat, and anyway the younger animals were more tender. She picked her target and took aim, pointing the rifle at its shoulder just over the heart. She breathed evenly and made herself still, the way she had learned back in Scotland. As always, she suffered a moment of regret for the beautiful animal she was about to destroy. Then she pulled the trigger. The shot came from farther up the valley, 200 or 300 yards away. Jay froze, his gun still pointed at Mac. The horses started, but the shot was too distant to give them a serious scare. Dobbs brought his mount under control, then drawled,
"If you shoot now, Jamison, you'll warn her, and she could get away."
Jay hesitated, then slowly lowered his gun. Mac sagged with relief. Jay said,
"I'll go after her. The rest of you stay here."
Mac realized that if only he could warn her, she might yet escape. He almost wished Jay had shot him. It might have saved Lizzie. Jay left the clearing and headed upstream, gun held ready.
"I have to make one of them fire," Mac realized.
There was an easy way to do that, run away.
"But what if I'm hit?" "I don't care. I'd rather die than be recaptured." Before caution could weaken his resolve, he broke into a run.
There was a moment of stunned silence before anyone realized what was happening. Then Peg screamed. Mac ran for the trees, expecting a bullet to slam into his back. There was a bang, followed by another. He felt nothing.
The shots had missed him. Before more shots came, he stopped in his tracks and raised his hands in the air. He had done it. He had given Lizzie her warning. He turned slowly, keeping his hands up.
"It's up to you now, Lizzie," he thought. "Good luck, my love."
Jay stopped when he heard shooting. It had come from behind him. It was not Lizzie who had fired, but someone back in the clearing. He waited, but there was no more gunfire. What did it mean? McCash could hardly have got hold of a weapon and loaded it. Anyway, the man was a coal miner. He knew nothing of guns. Jay guessed that Lennox or Dobbs had shot McCash. Whatever the truth, the all-important task was to capture Lizzie. Unfortunately, the shooting had warned her. He knew his wife. What would she do? Patience and caution were foreign to her. She rarely hesitated. She reacted quickly and decisively. By now she would be running this way. She would be almost back in the clearing before she thought to slow down and look ahead and make a plan. He found a spot where he could see clearly for 30 or 40 yards along the bank of the stream. He hid himself in the bushes. Then he cocked the flintlock of his rifle. Indecision struck him like a sudden pain. What would he do when she came into his sights? If he shot her, all his troubles would be over. He tried to pretend he was hunting deer. He would aim for the heart, just below the shoulder, for a clean kill. She came into view. She was half walking and half running, stumbling along the uneven river bank. She was wearing men's clothing again, but he could see her bosom heaving with exertion. She carried two rifles under her arm. He aimed at her heart, but he saw her naked, straddling him on the bed in the Chapel Street house, her breasts quivering as they made love, and he could not shoot. When she was 10 yards away, he stepped out of the undergrowth. She stopped in her tracks and gave a cry of horror. "Hello, darling," he said. She gave him a look of hatred. "Why couldn't you just let me go?" she said. "You don't love me." "No, but I need a grandchild," he said. She looked scornful.
"I'd rather die."
"That's the alternative," he said. There was a moment of chaos after Lennox fired his pistols at Mac. The horses were frightened by the close-range shooting. Peggs ran away. She stayed on, tied as she was, and hauled on the reins with her bound hands, but she could not stop it, and they disappeared into the trees. Dobbs's horse was bucking, and he fought to bring it under control. Lennox began hastily to reload his weapons. That was when Fishboy made his move. He ran at Dobbs's horse, jumped on behind him, and wrestled Dobbs out of the saddle. With a burst of exhilaration, Mac realized he was not yet beaten. Lennox dropped his pistols and ran to the rescue. Mac stuck out a foot and tripped Lennox. Dobbs fell off his horse, but one ankle got tangled in the rope by which Fishboy was tied to the saddle. The horse, now terrified, bolted. Fishboy clung to its neck for dear life. It ran out of sight, dragging Dobbs along the ground after it. With savage glee, Mac turned to face Lennox. Only the two of them were left in the clearing. At last it had come to a fist fight between them. "I'll kill him," Mac thought. Lennox rolled over and came up with a knife in his hand. He lunged at Mac. Mac dodged, then kicked Lennox's kneecap and danced out of range. Limping, Lennox came at him. This time he feinted with the knife, let Mac dodge the wrong way, then struck again. Mac felt a sharp pain in his left side. He swung with his right fist and hit Lennox a mighty blow to the side of the head. Lennox blinked and raised the knife. Mac backed away. He was younger and stronger than Lennox, but Lennox probably had much experience of knife fights. With a stab of panic, he realized that close combat was not the way to defeat a man with a knife. He had to change his tactics. Mac turned and ran a few yards, looking for a weapon. His eye lit on a rock about the size of his fist. He stooped and picked it up and turned. Lennox rushed him. Mac threw the rock. It hit Lennox squarely in the center of the forehead, and Mac gave a shout of triumph. Lennox stumbled, dazed. Mac had to make the most of his advantage. Now was the moment to disarm Lennox. Mac kicked out and connected with Lennox's right elbow. Lennox dropped the knife and gave a cry of dismay. Mac had him. He hit Lennox on the chin with all his might. The blow hurt his hand but gave him deep satisfaction. Lennox backed away, fear in his eyes, but Mac was after him fast. He punched Lennox in the belly, then hit him on each side of the head. Dazed and terrified, Lennox staggered. He was finished, but Mac could not stop. He wanted to kill the man. He grabbed Lennox by the hair, pulled his head down, and kneed him in the face. Lennox screamed and blood spurted from his nose. He fell to his knees, coughed, and vomited. Mac was about to hit him again when he heard Jay's voice say, "Stop, or I'll kill her." Lizzie walked into the clearing, and Jay followed, holding his rifle to the back of her head. Mac stared, paralyzed. He could see that Jay's rifle was cocked. If Jay even stumbled, the gun would blow her head off. Mac turned away from Lennox and moved towards Jay. He was still possessed by savagery.
"You've only got one shot," he snarled at Jay. "If you shoot Lizzie, I'll kill you."
"Then perhaps I should shoot you," Jay said.
"Yes,"
Mac said madly, moving towards him. "Shoot me." Jay swung the rifle. Mac felt a wild jubilation. The gun was no longer pointed at Lizzie. He walked steadily towards Jay. Jay took careful aim at Mac. There was a strange noise, and suddenly a narrow cylinder of wood was sticking out of Jay's cheek. Jay screamed in pain and dropped the rifle. It went off with a bang, and the ball flew past Mac's head. Jay had been shot in the face with an arrow. Mac felt his knees go weak. The noise came again, and a second arrow pierced Jay's neck. He fell to the ground. Into the clearing came Fishboy, his friend, and Peg, followed by 5 or 6 Indian men, all carrying bows. Mac began to shake with relief. He guessed that when Jay captured Fishboy, the other Indian had gone for help. The rescue party must have met up with the runaway horses. He did not know what had happened to Dobbs, but one of the Indians was wearing Dobbs's boots. Lizzie stood over Jay, staring at him, her hand covering her mouth. Mac went over and put his arms around her. He looked down at the man on the ground. Blood was pouring from his mouth. The arrow had opened a vein in his neck.
"He's dying," Lizzie said shakily.
Mac nodded. Fishboy pointed at Lennox, who was still kneeling. The other Indian seized him, threw him flat, and held him down. There was some conversation between Fishboy and the oldest of the others. Fishboy kept showing his fingers. They looked as if the nails had been pulled out, and Mac guessed that was how Lennox had tortured the boy. The older Indian drew a hatchet from his belt. With a swift, powerful motion, he cut off Lennox's right hand at the wrist. Mac said,
"By Jesus!"
Blood gushed from the stump, and Lennox fainted. The man picked up the severed hand, and with a formal air, presented it to Fishboy. He took it solemnly. Then he turned around and hurled it away. It flew up into the air and over the trees to fall somewhere in the woods. There was a murmur of approval from the Indians.
"A hand for a hand," Mac said quietly. "God forgive them," said Lizzie.
But they had not finished. They picked up the bleeding Lennox and placed him under a tree. They tied a rope to his ankle, looped the rope over a bough of the tree, and raised him until he was hanging upside down. Blood pumped from his severed wrist and pooled on the ground beneath him. The Indians stood around, looking at the grisly sight. It seemed they were going to watch Lennox die. They reminded Mac of the crowd at a London hanging. Peg came up to them and said,
"We ought to do something about the Indian boy's fingers."
Lizzie looked away from her dying husband. Peg said,
"Have you got something to bandage his hand?"
Lizzie blinked and nodded.
"I've got some ointment and a handkerchief we can use for bandages. I'll see to it." "No," Peg said firmly. "Let me do it."
"If you wish."
Lizzie found a jar of ointment and a silk handkerchief and gave them to Peg. Peg detached Fishboy from the group around the tree. Although she did not speak his language, she seemed to be able to communicate with him. She led him down to the stream and began to bathe his wounds.
"Mac,"
said Lizzie. He turned to her. She was crying.
"Jay is dead," she said.
Mac looked at him. He was completely white. The bleeding had stopped and he was motionless. Mac bent and felt for a heartbeat. There was none.
"I loved him once," Lizzie said.
"I know. I want to bury him."
Mac got a spade from their kit. While the Indians watched Lennox bleed to death, Mac dug a shallow grave. He and Lizzie lifted Jay's body and placed it in the hole. Lizzie bent down and gingerly withdrew the arrows from the corpse. Mac shoveled soil over the body, and Lizzie began to cover the grave with stones. Suddenly Mac wanted to get away from this place of blood. He rounded up the horses. There were now 10, the 6 from the plantation, plus the 4 Jay and his gang had brought. Mac was struck by the peculiar thought that he was rich. He owned 10 horses. He began to load the supplies.
The Indian stirred. Lennox seemed to be dead. They left the tree and came over to where Mac was loading the horses. The oldest man spoke to Mac. Mac did not understand a word, but the tone was formal. He guessed the man was saying that justice had been done. They were ready to go. Fishboy and Peg came up from the waterside together. Mac looked at the boy's hand. Peg had made a nice job of the bandage. Fishboy said something, and there followed an exchange in the Indian language which sounded quite angry. At last, all the Indians but Fishboy walked away. "Is he staying?" Mac asked Peg. She shrugged. The other Indians went eastward, along the river valley towards the rising sun, and soon disappeared into the woods. Mac got on his horse. Fishboy unroped a spare horse from the line and mounted it. He went ahead. Peg rode beside him. Mac and Lizzie followed. "Do you think Fishboy is going to guide us?" Mac said to Lizzie. "It looks like it. But he hasn't asked a price of any kind."
"No.
I wonder what he wants." Lizzie looked at the two young people riding side by side. "Can't you guess?" she said. "Oh," said Mac. "You think he's in love with her?"
"I think he wants to spend a little more time with her."
"Well, well." Mac became thoughtful. As they headed west along the river valley, the sun came up behind them, throwing their shadows on the land ahead. It was a broad valley, beyond the highest range, but still in the mountains. There was a fast-moving stream of pure cold water bubbling along the valley floor, teeming with fish. The hillsides were densely forested and alive with game. On the highest ridge, a pair of golden eagles came and went, bringing food to the nest for their young.
"It reminds me of home," said Lizzie.
"Then we'll call it High Glen," Mac replied. They unloaded the horses in the flattest part of the valley bottom, where they would build a house and clear a field. They camped on a patch of dry turf beneath a wide-spreading tree. Peg and Fishboy were rummaging through a sack, looking for a saw, when Peg found the broken iron collar. She pulled it out and stared quizzically at it. She looked uncomprehendingly at the letters. She had never learned to read.
"Why did you bring this?" she said.
Mac exchanged glances with Lizzie. They were both recalling the scene by the river in the old High Glen, back in Scotland, when Lizzie had asked Mac the same question. Now he gave Peg the same answer, but this time there was no bitterness in his voice, only hope.
"Never to forget," he said with a smile. "Never."
That was A Place Called Freedom by Ken Follett. Read by Sean Barrett. We do hope you have enjoyed listening to this Chivers audiobook. For details of other Chivers recordings, please contact us and we'll be delighted to send you a catalogue listing all our titles, as well as information about our most recent releases. Our telephone number and address can be found on the box cover or catalogue.